Now, I thank God for these little paper clips, otherwise I'd never be able to get this thing attached properly. Well, no, we've gone through three clips in this class, so I keep having to resort to paper clips, so works quite well. So, yes?
When is the next skeptics class?
That's something being organized by Ross Hoagland, so talk to Ross, but we're have that in the works. We also have in the works a star party for that saddle up in near Wrightwood, so we're going to make that happen. Like somebody was talking to me about, well, why don't we rent that 60-inch telescope on Mount Wilson? Now, responses, all of those of you who were there, remember, boy, you can do a lot better with your own telescope in a better location. So that was a shock to discover that my 11-inch telescope outperformed the 60-inch.
Yes.
So it is amazing that it makes a real difference if you get a good sight. And, of course, a wide field of view. I mean, that thing has such an incredibly narrow field of view. We'd look at a galaxy and you'd be looking at the very center of it and you couldn't see anything else. So,
100-inch does a little bit.
Yeah, but you can't rent the 100-inch. So, well, like Mel, I was the first one in my family to come to Christ. Like him, I was also raised in a family of unbelievers. And but if I can encourage you, Mel and Donna, the first one to come to Christ in my family besides me was my younger sister. And then number three was my grandmother at age 86. So, and both my parents came to Christ in their late 70s. So, and, you know, I can empathize with Mel in the sense that, you know, here I was a non-Christian. It wasn't that I was antagonistic to the Christian faith. I just didn't see any good reasons to believe. And it took my astronomy to bring me to the point of realizing there had to be a God. And then going through the Bible and checking out what it had to say about the origin and structure of the universe and realizing it actually did predict future scientific discoveries, the other holy books didn't. It still took me 18 months after I started reading the Bible before I could sign my name in the back of that Gideon Bible that I got at age 11. But I've discovered through reasons to believe there's a lot of people like Mel and myself, people raised in non-Christian families, haven't been to church. Outwardly, they appear like they're rejecting the Christian faith, but really they're searching for reasons to believe. And if you provide them with those reasons, it makes all the difference in the world, as it did in Mel's life. So, Mel, thank you for sharing. And, you know, I remember that day when Mel first came in the class. I took a look at him and said, he's a spitting image of Harlow Shapley. And the older he gets, the more he looks like him. So... So, and it took me another couple of weeks to discover he was actually related to Harlow Shapley. So, interesting world. He had been gone the past 2 weeks. In fact, these past 2 weeks have been an interesting situation. I have not been gone from home as long as I was the last 2 weeks since 1988. That's when I took a trip to South and Central Africa. And I remember when I took that trip saying, I can't be away that long again, but... This time, you know, Kathy said, look, this is a brand new seminary that's starting up in Redding, California. You're in on the ground floor. It's something that we can actually video record and use to train our volunteers at Reasons to Believe. She says, you got to do it. And then she says, I'm so busy anyway trying to manage things at Reasons to Believe that I'll be okay. Worked out except for our cats. They started to misbehave after about 6 days, so then I had to regularly talk to the cats on the phone. So, well, the older one thought that, you know, Kathy had divorced me, and he was really mad that I was no longer there. So by talking to him on the phone, he realized I'm still around, and he began to be okay again. So, which was interesting, because one of the talks I gave at the seminary was on the behavior of soulish animals, so I was... actually able to use a few of the ones that we've had in our home over the years as examples of that very thing. It was an unusual situation. It was an intensive class. In fact, it's a seminary that only does intensives. They don't have semester-long courses. And the whole goal is that you either come for a week or 2 weeks and you're done. And it's an interesting strategy because people don't have to quit their jobs. They basically take some vacation time and moreover, the Simpson University up there provides housing for $100 a week while you're taking the class. That's, well, that's if you take it during June. when the other students aren't around. You know, their dorms are empty, excuse me, so they make you a good deal. We're also finding that this is very attractive to people in ministry, because a lot of pastors and ministers get a week study week. Now, the class I was teaching was 2 weeks long, so it didn't work. But I didn't find out till the last day. I had 6 pastors in the class. I had 3 medical doctors, I had a dentist, a computer programmer. Everybody had at least 1 degree. And so I was wondering why they were keeping up so well. In fact, after the 3rd lecture, I said, you know what, I'm going to put a bonus lecture into this because I think you guys can really keep pace with this. And they said, sure, let's go for it. So I actually wound up doing a little more teaching than I had planned. And kind of what I did is I took 7 years' worth of content in this class and squished it down into 40 hours. So, but the other thing was good discipline for me as I created a full visual complement to the courses. So we now have 20 lectures that have been video recorded, and each lecture has about 100 of these keynote slides to support the material, along with video clips. So it's going to be our most extensive teaching tool for our Reasons Institute online class structure for training our volunteer apologists. Moreover, we got at least 1 other seminary that's interested in making the course available to their students. And because it is video recorded, I don't have to teach it again. So next time when they want to offer the course, we can just make available the DVDs. And I didn't have to grade it because one of our volunteers, a medical researcher in Florida, said, I'll be your proctor. So he's going to take care of the grading because there's a concern. You know, I just can't take quite that much time off. But I was concerned because there were between, say, well, it was about mid, about 30, 35 people in the class. I probably had over 40 because some were coming and going. Because the way we structured the class was you could take it for graduate seminary credit, or you could just come in and audit it. Although the seminary charged a fee for those auditing it as well. But that proved to be a really good teaching dynamic because the people auditing the class were more mature, better educated than the seminary students by and large, and they really helped me teach the seminary students. In particular, there was a medical doctor and a couple of the pastors that really worked with the students in the class. And so, interestingly, the people auditing the class really upped the game for all those taking it for credit. Usually it's the other way around. So I think the seminary learned a lesson, because mine was the only class that was really open to anybody who wanted to sign up and audit it. And I said, you know, this is a good thing to do for all the classes, because, you know, if you get that kind of people coming in, it can really not hold the graduate students back, but actually encourage them. And I had some, like a couple of the pastors had over 40 years of experience, so their experience really helped. But I had a concern. You know, I said, look, I'm with you for 5 hours a night, 10 nights. And I said, and I knew the other seminary professors were very relational people. And I said, I was worried that the students were going to expect the same from me. So in the very first lecture, I told them, look, I've got Asperger's syndrome. It's fairly severe. If you're expecting me to read your emotions, I can't. If you're expecting me to read your body language, I can't do that. Nevertheless, I got one young student, the youngest student in the class, who complained that I wasn't being sensitive to his feelings. And so I had to explain to him again, look, I can't read your feelings. So, but the problem is the other faculty members were very relational. And so, you know, I was kind of an odd man out there. But also, I was giving them, they said, you know, we've never seen a course that was this content heavy before. And I said, what was the whole idea? So, but what I was doing in the class is something similar to what we're actually touching on here in Psalm 139. And we've done Psalm 104. And Psalm 104 makes the case that God's the author of all life, and that God is intimately involved in making sure just the right life forms are on the planet at just the right time. Remember, we talked about how the fossil record shows these interruptions, how God will step in and remove life wholesale from the planet and replace it with new life. And he does that all the way through the past 3.83 billion years. And, you know, if God is that intimate and involved with all the different species that he's placed on the earth over the past 3.83 billion years, as you see in Psalm 104, all that's done for the specific benefit of the future human species. In other words, God's been working very carefully with all these species of life for 3.83 billion years with one thing in mind, to ensure that when he creates human beings, they'll have all the resources they need to fulfill the purposes that God places upon them. If all that's really true, doesn't it make sense what King David says in Psalm 139? God predetermines the day of your birth, he predetermines the day of your death, and he's in total control of all the events that take place in your life. As King David says, every one of my thoughts was recorded by you before I was born in my mother's womb. Everything's under God's control. But I had one student in the class, again, the youngest student, who was a little bit concerned I wasn't able to read his emotional state as accurately as he wanted me to. And, you know, he was coming from a perspective of an Arminian perspective, that it's free will and not God's predestination. And, you know, maybe God's not so much in control. Maybe it's a theistic evolutionary perspective, but God's a lot more hands-off in what he brings about in the face of the earth. And I later found out that he'd been through a lot of emotional pain, and his brother's been through even more emotional pain, and he just couldn't put that kind of credit to God for all the circumstances he had in his life. Says he had to blame it on the fact that God just wasn't that intimately involved. And I said, you know, I need to come up with an object lesson for the student. Amazingly, God provided one. And I'm just going to share it to you through some photos that I took while I was up there. Because three of my students were writers. In fact, one was a professional writer for outdoors magazines. He writes for four different outdoors magazines, and he writes an outdoors column for the local newspaper. And so he said, well, you know, we're doing Monday through Friday, and then next Monday through Friday. He says, this is a great place, and he saw some of my mountain photos. He said, you know, are you going to do any kind of a hike on the weekend? And I said, well, I was actually thinking of hiking up into Avalanche Gulch of Mount Shasta. I mean, it's a beautiful mountain, and it's snowed in. And, you know, I got my boots with me. So I said, I think I'm going to do that early Saturday morning, because that's really the only time slot I had was Saturday morning, nice and early. He said, well, I'm actually going to go up the summit, because I'm writing an article on how to climb Mount Shasta with complete safety. And I'm going to take 2 days. And I'm going up with four other friends. And he says, I'll be there Saturday and Sunday. And I said, well, I'll be there Saturday morning. He said, well, we're not going to see one another then. But I said, you know, I'd love to see your photos when you come back. And he said, well, I'd like to see yours. So anyway, that was the plan. And then Friday, actually three of us were all staying in the same home, three of the professors, and one of them heard what I was going to do. And he says, look, I'm a runner just like you, and I'd love to go with you, but I want to see Castle Lake first. And by the way, I can't get up at 6 a.m. to do this. Can we start at 10? So I said, well, it's because he had an appointment. It wasn't because he was sleeping in. I mean, after all, he was teaching the afternoon. I was teaching the evening. I was the one who should have been sleeping in. But anyway, I planned to leave at 6, and he says, no, wait for me until 10, then we'll go. And let's do Castle Lake first, and then we'll do the mountain in the afternoon. So I said, fine, let's do it that way. Anyway, let me pick up the story. If we can turn the lights off, you'll be able to see these a little bit better, because I think the slides show the story better. So this is Castle Lake that we visited first, and it's only 6,000 feet, so I was rather shocked that the lake was mostly frozen. And my goal was to go up to Heart Lake, and then we had to do a rather tough stream crossing, and the professor was with me, saw the water rushing down the stream and how I was wobbling my way across logs, says, you know what, why don't you go up the Heart Lake by yourself, and I'll just kind of wander around the shore of the lake here a little bit and get some photographs. So I started going up this slope, and I discovered there are no boot tracks here. I'm the first one to do this. And then I got up a little bit higher and realized it's getting extremely steep, and I don't have an ice axe, and I don't have crampons. So I wound up turning back, met the professor, and he'd gone about a quarter of a mile around the lake, and I says, well, you know, he showed me some of the photos, says, I'm going to see what I can do. Well, I managed to get a mile around the lake. He missed the trail. He had to tramp over a lot of snow, but once you got past it, he actually picked up a bit of a trail. And this is kind of what I saw going around the other end of the lake, and found this really nice waterfall coming down into the lake. By the way, I returned by myself to this lake 5 days later, and this so much as the ice had melted in just 5 days. After all, it was 98 in the valley, so it did warm things up a bit, and got some nice shots of the clouds on the lake, and then walked around. But the professor was with me the Saturday, says, look, we didn't get anything because this lake is famous for some shots of Mount Shasta. So I was walking around the lake, and there's no shots of Mount Shasta. You got to get all the way around the other part of the lake. And again, with all the snow and the ice, and I didn't have the equipment and wasn't passable. So what I wound up doing, well, actually, you can get a little bit of a view. This is the best you can get from the shore. Okay, not bad. So I want to see the whole mountain. So what I did is I climbed up the hillside, and it was a lot steeper than I thought, but I managed to get up there, and this is about 300 feet up. And then I got a shot about 500 feet above the lake, and this is what it looked like. So I finally got a nice, clear shot of Mount Shasta. And incidentally, this was the route that we went up Saturday, up this little thing here. That's Avalanche Gulch. I'll show you those slides in a minute.
How high is Shasta?
Shasta's 14,162 feet. It's the eighth highest mountain in California. And from the parking lot to the top, it's snow the whole way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, yeah. If you go in August, there's a trail for about 2 miles. That's Black Butte in the foreground. And way over to the left, if you can see it, that's Mount Hood. Even though it's hundreds of miles away, it is visible. So, and then, and here we are at the parking lot for our hike up Mount Shasta. It was all socked in, which is kind of disappointing. Couldn't really see the peak. And the parking lot is 7,000 feet, so I started to hike in. It was one of these trails because it was snow that had been tramped on a bit. And I noticed everybody else had cross-country skis and poles, or they had crampons, or they had snowshoes. All we had were boots. And it was kind of 3 steps forward, 2 steps back. And the professor that was with me, he lasted 1/4 mile, and he says, I'm heading back to the car. And he says, I'll just wait for you until you come back. And I says, well, you know, I'm just going to head on up. And so this is at about 8,000 feet. There's a lady ahead of me who's got the right equipment. And as you come into a place called Horse Camp, the Sierra Club actually has a stone hut. And it's bigger than what it looks, because that thing will hold 50 people.
Wow.
And 50. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the place to go just before you do the ascent of... you can actually see that they're well prepared for the heavy snows, because they have this steel side there with a 3-foot gap. That's so you can actually get into the place when there's a lot of snow. But anyway, as I was going up the gulch, there was a 15-second break where you could actually see the summit. So I quickly got my camera out, and that's what it looks like with a telephoto, and kind of gives you an idea of the route up to the top of the mountain, the basic route as you go up here, then up to the top there, then over. It's about 9 or 10 hours to climb it, depending what shape you're in. And now I'm in what's called the Causeway, which is kind of the main route at the Avalanche Gulch. And if you look, you can actually see three climbers here. And they decided that the weather was getting too rough to go up to the summit, so they were going to hike to the top of that thing. And that was going to be there. And here's a close-up of the three going on up. And they had crampons and ice axes. They were doing fine. So, and then that's kind of a view up into the gulch again. And all those little things there, those aren't trees. Those are people making the ascent. So you go up, that's the route to get to the chimneys. And just when you get to the top of that gulch, there's a set of rock chimneys you can squeeze yourself into and go up a couple hundred feet. And that gets you to a ridge. But here's an approaching storm, which caused a lot of people to turn back. 15,000 people a year try to climb this thing, 5,000 make it per year. Now, here I am a mile off the trail getting these photos, because I said, if I go off here and get, because I wasn't planning to climb it. I didn't have the equipment. I just wanted to get some good photos. And I saw the storm coming and says, I'm not going to get any good photos. So I got my pack on and started to head back. And then suddenly I ran into this guy on a snowboard. Here he is on a snowboard. And he stops and talks to me, and he says, which way to the trail to Bunny Flat? And I said, well, it's about, you know, 3/4 of a mile over that way. And then I noticed that he was snowblind. And then I noticed he was one of my students. He was this guy who was writing this thing. And I said, you know, how did you get separated? And he says, well, you know, I told you I was going to do it in 2 days. Things came up, and I had to change my plan and do it in 1 day. And so what he did is he met up with his four friends early Saturday morning. He took off at 2 a.m., caught up with his friends because they had camped out at 10,000 feet at a place called Helen Lake, caught up with them. They climbed the summit, went back down to their camp, and he left them there because they were going to spend another night there. They were taking 3 days. And he went down on his own. As soon as he got about 500 feet below their campsite, he got snow blindness. And what happens is your vision goes blurry. You can still see light. And so what he was doing was just trying to say, I'm going to stay in the very bottom part of the gulch because I can use gravity to help me get down and hope I meet somebody. Well, the first thing he met was me. And so what I did is I guided him all the way back to the parking lot. And because I went with another professor, we had two drivers. So I was able to drive his truck back to his house. And 2 days later, he got his sight back. So, but what are the chances of that happening? I mean, I wasn't planning to be in the mountain at that time. I wasn't planning to be in that spot. He wasn't planning to be in the mountain or that spot either. And we just, quote, met one another. And, you know, he needed help, and it was all able to work out. Anyway, provided a fantastic object lesson for the class of how God really is in control of all nature. And if he is in control of all nature, that means he's in control of our lives. And said, you know, this is a classic situation where things that we had planned on did not happen. God changed the circumstances and was able to get him out. And then he showed up Monday, but his wife brought him, I noticed. And that's because he still couldn't quite see right, and he needed his wife to drive him. But by Tuesday, he was able to drive himself. Yes. Well, he made a mistake. He wore his contact lenses. You're not supposed to do that when you're climbing in that kind of a snow. And I said, well, do you have glasses? He says, yes, at home. And I said, well, do you have your cleaning fluid with you for your contacts? Because when I met him in this position, I said, let's just get out your cleaning fluid. He says, I don't have it with me. Because I said, you know, if we can clean your lenses out and put them back in, that might help. Because I didn't know whether he was snowblind or not, because he didn't have any of that sandpapery feeling in his eyes, which is usually the symptom of snowblindness. He didn't have that. But all that stuff was at home, so really the only option was to drive him home. So, but as you can imagine, he's changing slightly the article he's writing on how to climb Mount Shasta in total safety. So... And the other thing I noticed is the sunglasses he had, they were wraparound sunglasses, but when you climb Mount Shasta in June, you're supposed to wear wraparound sunglasses that fit tight against your skin. They're just like the goggles you wear in the pool, because there's so much, I mean, June is the time you got the greatest solar UV coming in, and it's snow that's reflecting it. Moreover, this avalanche gulch acts like a lens. So it's actually the light is reflecting on it and coming back, and we didn't realize his light was coming in underneath his glasses because it wasn't quite tight at the bottom. It was close, but not tight enough.
So would it have grazed cornea, or what? I'm curious.
Well, after 3 days, his vision was completely recovered. So, but yeah, I mean, what it does is causes damage on the cornea, but. You know, he was worried he was going to lose his sight permanently. He says, no, with snow blindness, you do recover. But it may take some time. Well, you know, in 3 days, he was fine. Anyway, when I did meet him, I said, I'll rescue you in one condition, that you actually show me your summit photos. Well, I've got some of the summit photos for you. So I'll just show you these quickly. This is the base camp of his four friends at 10,000 feet. That's really the easy way to do it. You know, climb from 7,000 feet to 10,000 feet the first day, set up a camp, and then take off early. And you really do want to take off early because there are avalanches that come in the afternoon. They don't call it Avalanche Gulch for nothing. So, pardon me? Well, in August, you get them every few minutes. But that's, by the way, that's why the mountain was so crowded. This is the safest time to climb Mount Shasta. That was part of his article. If you want to climb Mount Shasta, you wait till the snow reaches a certain condition of softness, not too soft, but not real icy. And, you know, June, early June is really the time to go. So, but I went to the parking lot. There were thousands of cars in the parking lot. So I guess everybody else figured that out, too.
You know, Walter Martin had a saying, crazy I may be, stupid I'm not.
Well, the problem in August is when the snow melts, the rock is exposed. And because of the steepness of the terrain, those rocks are easily destabilized. So, yeah, June is really the time to go. So, anyway, here they are taking off in the base camp. Sun's not up yet, but they're tramping on out. And then here is sunrise as they're going up the upper part of Avalanche Gulch. Yeah, I mean, my guess is there was probably 2,000 people on the mountain that day. So, now, they were going at different times, but you know, everywhere you look, there were climbers going up. So, and then this next shot is one of the steeper parts of the Avalanche Gulch. It's a lot steeper than it looks, but that's a professionally guided tour. If you pay $1,500, a guide will get you to the top and back and actually make your tent and put your sleeping bag and feed you and all that kind of stuff. So a few people do it that way. And this is the steepest part of all. Actually, the part right down here is the steepest part, but it gets above 45 degrees. And as you approach the top, it begins to level out a bit where it's only this steep. And then you finally reach a place that's called Misery Hill. And the reason why they call it Misery Hill is by the time you get here, you're so tired, you really aren't ready for another steep pitch. But you got this nice little flat area first, then it gets steep when you get up there. And basically the route is to go up here and then go up along the top. And this is what it looks like from the top. This is my friend Billy looking straight down into the valley below. And you can see his crampons there. And then he, this is about 90 degrees away from that. That's another shot. This is actually the route he took to get up to the summit. He came up this little thing here. So, but then I got that shot there.
Do people try to get up all the way with cross-country skis, or is it that be a combination?
Oh, no. Once you get into the gulch, you got to take your skis off and put your crampons on, and then you put your skis on your back and get your ice axe out. That's the standard technique. So, although my friend Billy here, my student Billy, had a snowboard, and his reason is, I want to get down quickly, because he was doing it all one day. He needed to get down quickly. So he snowboarded a good chunk of the way down, and there he is at the top, not yet snowblind, and here he is darting his way down. I mean, he had pretty decent glasses, but not good enough for trying to climb it in June when the sun's out. So, and see, they're above the clouds. I was below the clouds, so I had no problems with my eyes because the clouds were keeping the sun out, but he was above the clouds, and that's the route down. It gets steeper than that. This gives you an idea. And you actually see climbers coming up as he is going down. And this is the steepest part of all. So anyway, that's kind of what it's like going up to the top there. I didn't have my equipment with me, and I didn't have time either, so I didn't do it. But I've done stuff like this up in British Columbia. And there's a mountain like this in the Sierras, too.
Although, how cold was it on top, do you know?
Oh, it's cold. Oh, yeah. I mean, you have to wear a parka when you get up on top. So everybody's got a parka on. So it's not like climbing Mount Rainier where you've got so much volcanic heat that you can actually keep warm when you're in the caldera. Mm-hmm. That's the fun thing about going up Mount Rainier. It's cold going up. When you get to the very summit, you can take your jacket off and everything because there's so much volcanic heat. In fact, if people actually sleep there overnight because it's so warm. But, of course, there's always a concern it could get too warm. So. Something else I discovered while I was up there, they have the equivalent, they call this the Yosemite Valley of the North. This is what's called Castle Crags, and it's a sheer granite. Not quite the 4,000 feet of sheer granite that you get in Yosemite, but this one here called Castle Dome, it's slightly more than 2,000 vertical feet. And you actually see a shot of Shasta there, and there's a close-up of Castle Dome. And another one. And there are actually people climbing it while I was there, but I passed and I got back. Okay. Anyway, it was a great object lesson for my class of God really is in control of everything. And before we jump into Psalm 139, while I was up there in Redding, a paper got published about Jupiter saving us. I mean, you know, here I rescued one of my students. Jupiter actually rescued planet Earth. And here's a shot that shows what the Earth looks like relative to Jupiter. So you get an idea how big Jupiter really is. In fact, the Earth could easily fit in just one of the hurricanes that's running on the surface of Mars. By the way, we think it's bad when a hurricane lasts 4 days. This particular hurricane's been running now for 350 years minimum. That's the first time it was spotted, was 350 years ago, and it's been running ever since. And as some of you might remember, back in 1994, Jupiter saved us from a nasty circumstance by taking the hit from comet Shoemaker-Levy 9. This is the damage that it caused. 21 fragments. What happened is the gravity of Jupiter was so powerfully acting on the comet, it broke it up into at least 21 pieces. And the pieces fell into the surface of Jupiter between July 16th and July 22nd in 1994. And this just shows you what happens when those pieces get absorbed into Jupiter. This one down here, which is hard to see, is actually a little bit bigger than the Earth. So, the temperature from the fireball was over 15,000 degrees centigrade. So that's how hot it was. The energy release of just one of these hits was 600 times the energy of all the nuclear weapons in the world's entire arsenal being exploded all at once. You know, most people consider that were to happen, if you were to explode all the nuclear weapons all at once on planet Earth, that would bring about the extinction of the human species, and just one of these hits is 600 times greater than that. So that was a good reason to thank God for Jupiter, that it took the hit and not us. So, but when this took place back in 1994, astronomers looking at the different asteroid and comet belts that we saw determined that probably Jupiter is going to get hit like this maybe once every century or two. And so it was a big surprise when some amateurs said, we think we see another blemish on the surface of Jupiter. And that happened in June of last year. Amateur astronomers actually make a major contribution to astrophysical research because there's tens of thousands of amateurs, many of them with really good telescopes and good back-end equipment. And so they're the ones that are typically discovering new comets. They're the ones discovering the novae. And they're the ones that are watching the planets. And so they announced to the astronomical community, we think Jupiter may have gotten hit again. And so that's when they started training the professional telescopes on and said, yep, you're right. But six amateurs saw the blemish before any professional astronomer did. And actually, as the astronomers looked at it, they realized that the amateurs did not see the actual collision event. It happened on the far side of Jupiter, and Jupiter had to rotate around sufficiently for the amateurs to pick up the blemish. Anyway, I have a photo here that shows what the blemish looked like 4 days later. This was taken with a Hubble Space Telescope, and the impact scar is right down here. Not quite as dramatic as the breakup of Shoemaker-Levy, because it's only about a little bit bigger than the size of the Pacific Ocean. Still a fairly major thing, but what was really caught the attention of the astronomers is they noticed this time only one blemish spot. And so as they studied this in more detail and got all the information from the amateurs as well as different professional observatories, they discerned that this was not a comet. It was an asteroid. It was an asteroid between 1/2 and 1 kilometer in diameter. And asteroids do a lot more damage than comets. And the other thing that concerned them is they said, look, there's only 16 years between this comet event and this asteroid event, which means that we've been way off in our calculations of the risk of getting clobbered by asteroids and comets. And a research paper in the Astrophysical Journal, by the way, the reason why we're only finding out about this now, it's taken them an entire year to analyze all the data. So the astronomers were reluctant to actually publish anything on this event until they had all their ducks in a row. And that didn't happen until May of this year. And then in June 1st issue, the Astrophysical Journal, they said this is what's really going on. Because the first speculation was this is just a piece of a comet. And now we realize, no, it's not a comet at all. It's an asteroid that crashed into it. And the presumption was asteroid collision events would be very rare. This is telling us maybe they're not rare at all. In fact, the astronomical community has basically upped its estimate of events of this nature with Jupiter by a factor of between 5 and 10 times. But that also means the risk for planet Earth likewise goes up. And what they also did in the research, two papers were published, and basically what the astronomers are concluding is, you know, we need to be a little more... we need to give Jupiter a little more credit than we've been giving it. And what they recognize is that Jupiter plays a far more important role than we realize in protecting planet Earth from getting these kinds of collision events. And so, and I've actually written up an article for this for today's New Reason to Believe, pointing out that if Jupiter were a little less massive or a little further away from the Earth, then we would be getting the damage more frequently than we do. And by the way, this means there are many more encounters than just what we're seeing here. Because when we look at the dynamics of the solar system, Jupiter will typically deflect the asteroid or the comet. And you're going to get about 10 times more deflections than you will actual collision events. So it tells us the number of encounters is much higher than just these two we've seen over the past 16 years. By the way, it also tells us that Jupiter is getting bigger because it's collecting stuff. So, yes?
Are the deflections randomized so that as many would come in towards the Earth as would go away, or is there a preferential thing that keeps these deflections from getting closer to the Earth?
It's the latter. Because of the position of Jupiter, it kind of, when it deflects a comet or an asteroid, there's actually a cone where you won't get events taking place. And the inner solar system bodies will be within that cone. So basically it protects the inner solar system bodies from getting those hits. Many of them are deflected out of the solar system entirely. Others are put into, you know, really very big elliptical orbits. So, and by the way, Saturn does the same thing, and Uranus and Neptune to a much smaller degree. In fact, what astronomers have done is try to calculate where do you get the best possible protection screen for preventing Earth from getting hit by asteroids and comets? Well, one of the things you've got to watch out for, you don't want the screening planets to be too close or too massive. If they are, they'll disturb the orbit of the Earth. So some screening situations are a problem. Or if you get, say, 2 or 3 planets that offer a very good protection, but they set up mean motion resonances with one another, and that will disturb the orbit of the Earth. So in terms of where you can put gas giant planets, where you get the best protection without disturbing the orbit of the Earth, calculations show it works best if the biggest gas giant planet is closest to the planet you're trying to protect, the second biggest gas giant is the next closest, and then you've got a couple more that are farther away, that are smaller. Well, that's the configuration of our solar system. they basically determine our solar system has the best possible configuration for protecting Earth from getting hit by too many asteroids or comets. The other thing we've been able to notice in looking at extrasolar planetary systems is they tend to have way more comets and asteroids than we do. And so the fact is that already we have a minimal number of asteroids and comets, and we got the best possible screen of gas giant planets protecting us from getting those hits. We now know that our solar system lost about 99% of its asteroids and comets by an event that where Jupiter and Saturn interacted with one another. What basically was happening in the early history of the solar system is there was this huge belt of asteroids and comets, which we now call the Kuiper Belt. But the Kuiper Belt at that time, this is 4.5 billion years ago, was roughly centered where Saturn is. Right now, it's beyond the orbit of Uranus, or beyond the orbit of Neptune. But at that time, it was centered where Saturn is. And the dynamics is such that a big gas giant planet will interact with this belt of comets and asteroids, causing both of them to move outward. But you get the greatest outward movement of the planet that's closest to the center of concentration of the comets and asteroids. So the net effect was Saturn moved out more rapidly than Jupiter or Uranus or Neptune. And so Saturn was moving the fastest and dragging all these asteroids and comets out with it. And it reached a point where Saturn was making exactly one orbit around the Sun for every two orbits of Jupiter. And that's what we call a 2-1 resonance, which means, every second orbit of Jupiter, you're going to get Saturn and Jupiter lining up, which means they line up to give a gravitational pull or a tug on the bodies in front and back of them. And that happens frequently enough where it actually destabilizes the whole belt of asteroids and comets. And what happened at that point is a whole bunch of asteroids and comets left the solar system, a whole bunch more rushed into the inner solar system. And that's what's called the late heavy bombardment, where there was this pulse of giant asteroids and comets leaving the solar system but actually bombarding the inner solar system. A lot of them wound up getting sucked into the sun. Excuse me. But a lot of them also crashed into the solar system bodies. Yeah, you can turn the lights on, thanks. In fact, at that time, Earth took over 17,000 hits as big as this one on Jupiter or bigger. And right after that, you got the origin of life. That's one of the reasons why we now know the origin of life happened quickly, because the late heavy bombardment would have liquefied the surface of the Earth into a hot ocean of lava. It would have taken some time to cool down. And when it cools down to where you got liquid water being able to form again, immediately you got the origin of life. So no time difference between the end of the late heavy bombardment and the origin of life 3.83 billion years ago. Yes?
Jupiter is a gas ball. Why is there a blemish when it got hit? What is that blemish?
That blemish is from the superheating of the upper atmosphere of Jupiter. In fact, what astronomers have been hoping to do in looking at these collision events is to see what happens as the collision is absorbed down into the interior of Jupiter. They kind of got their wish with this one, because now they got a second chance. But the problem was the collision took place on the far side, because what they're really wanting was to actually see one of these events where they could see the before, during, and after. And all we're getting is the after effects. So once again, we really don't have a clean picture of what happened, except on the top of the atmosphere. What we do notice is when it collides with the upper atmosphere, it superheats the upper atmosphere. You get a fireball of more than 15,000 degrees centigrade, and it causes disturbances in the weather patterns in the upper atmosphere of Jupiter, and there's chemical reactions that are going on. So, and they're able to calculate the kinetic energy release, how it's 600 times the igniting of all the world's nuclear weapons at one time. So So, and of course, if that were to hit Earth, you would get a more devastating impact because now it's crashing into something that's not all that soft. It's hitting hard ground. And so you're going to get a big energy release as it hits. So, but the bottom line of all this, we now are much more appreciative of the value of having these gas giant planets in our solar system. So when all of you celebrate Thanksgiving, you might want to say a few words of thanks for Uranus, Neptune, Saturn, and Jupiter.
Do we do sacrifices for them?
No, no, we don't do that. But yeah, and it's very delicate. Each one of those gas giant planets, bring it a little closer, a little farther away, you got a problem. Because if it's too close, it's going to disrupt our orbit. If it's too far, it's not going to provide adequate protection. And as we studied in Psalm 104, you want a few of these to get through. Because through a few of these getting through, you now have a means to remove life from the planet wholesale so God can step in and replace it. It's a property of all life to die off, verse 26 of Psalm 104. But God recreates and renews the face of the earth. And he does that because it's necessary to have the right life on a planet at the right time to compensate for the changing physics of the sun, the earth, and the moon. As we notice, the sun gets brighter and brighter. And therefore, it's crucial for the Creator to pull life away from the earth that's inappropriate for the changed luminosity of the sun and put new life on it that is able to change the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere at the appropriate amount. Yes?
Does the sun, as it grows in luminosity, does it grow in size?
Yes. Right now, it's in a burning phase where the growth in size is relatively modest. But as you go out about 3 billion years from now, it's going to become quite dramatic. And a little bit past 4 billion years from now, the sun's diameter will grow so large it'll encompass the orbit of planet Earth. And so when that happens, Earth will be vaporized. So, yeah, your bomb shelter will not be effective at that time. So, there was a question over here I was missing. No? Okay. Before we jump into our lesson, one more paper got published, which is also on planets. And for the first time, astronomers have got enough accurate data on the stars that support extraplanetary system. We now have discovered 463 planets outside of our solar system. But what this study is all about is actually looking at the physics of the stars that are supporting the planets and actually measuring their composition and using it as a basis to determine what would be the composition of the terrestrial planets in the same system. Because what they're discovering are gas giant planets. Big ones like Jupiter are easy to detect. Planets the size of Earth are very difficult to detect. The smallest planet we have found, ordinary planet, not one orbiting a neutron star, is about twice the size of the Earth. And we're on the verge of being able to discover planets the size of the Earth. But the evidence already tells us we're going to find a lot of them. But what this paper was doing is in advance determining what the composition of these planets will be. And they were quite surprised to discover they're not going to be like planet Earth. In other words, they're going to be dominated by carbon compounds, not by silicon and magnesium and iron compounds like planet Earth. And so you're going to have things like silicon carbide and titanium carbide in the great amounts. And what they were discovering is when you look at the range of elements that these stars have, they're very carbon rich. And I think I've showed you this a few months ago. When you look at planet Earth's carbon content, it measures 1,200 times greater or 1,200 times less than what you'd expect for planets of its size orbiting stars like the sun. And now we're realizing that's probably modest. That's assuming a star like the sun, but what we're discovering is these extraplanetary systems, the stars, are not like the sun. They're loaded with a lot more carbon than the sun has, and therefore we're even more carbon poor than we had recognized in the past. And, you know, you need carbon for life, but if you got too much carbon, you got a real problem, because with too much carbon, you're going to have an atmosphere loaded with carbon dioxide and a carbon monoxide and various acids, which would all be deadly for advanced life. And by the way, they would trap huge amounts of heat. So you might have a planet orbiting the star at the right distance, but with an atmosphere loaded with carbon molecules, it'll trap so much heat, it'll be hot enough to melt lead on the surface. So, incidentally, we're also extremely poor in nitrogen. Even though our atmosphere is 80% nitrogen, our planet actually measures 2,400 times less abundant in nitrogen than we would expect for a planet of our size and our distance from its star. But yeah, this new discovery in the Astrophysical Journal is really underlining that we're probably even more carbon poor than we presumed in the first place, and we're carbon poor by a really wide margin. And therefore, it's really underlining the rare earth hypothesis. That little word is being used more and more in the scientific literature. The recognition that planets like Earth with the capacity to support life are either non-existent or extremely rare, which is why even atheists are now acknowledging the universe is hostile to advanced life except planet Earth. So, not that they're giving up on their atheism. As we've written before, what the atheists are now saying is, well, now that we know that Carl Sagan is wrong, that there aren't planets all over the place that could have advanced life, but only planet Earth, and therefore the universe is hostile to advanced life, then that means that God either doesn't exist or he's not an all-loving, all-caring God. And the argument is, if God was all-powerful and all-caring and all-loving, he wouldn't confine us to this tiny pale blue dot that we call planet Earth. Of course, the response to that is, from God's perspective, the human species is still a toddler, and he's got us on a playpen on purpose. It wouldn't be safe to let us out of that playpen, given the immaturity that we now manifest. And as you see in the last two chapters of the Bible, he has promised to release us to a habitat space far bigger than anything we can imagine. Okay, with that, let me jump into our lesson here. And what I really want to get to, because we've been on this for some time, looking at the life of King David. King David wrote Psalm 139, how David saw many instances of God supernaturally intervening to save his life and the lives of his 30 men. And in the case of King David, you can count 20 instances between the time he was 17, when Samuel anointed him to be the future king of Israel, and when he actually became king roughly at age 30. Of course, before he killed Goliath, he said he killed a lion in defense of his father's sheep, and he killed a bear, actually took the sheep right out of the bear's mouth while he was killing the bear. That's quite a feat in itself. Then he had a death duel with Goliath, and then his friends turned against him. Here he was a servant of Saul, playing music to help calm down Saul's spirit, and Saul twice tried to kill him with a spear in his house. And I would argue it's a miraculous escape. Here you got a small room, and you got Saul with a spear, and he's a skilled soldier, and twice David is able to elude the spear attack with a spear thrown at him in a small room. And then, what does Saul do? He's eager to take David's life, so he says, look, if you want to marry my daughter, you got to come up with 100 Philistines' foreskins. His goal is to have the Philistines kill him rather than he himself. And so what does David do? He comes up with 200 foreskins. And so Saul reluctantly gives him his daughter in marriage. And then Saul commands his attendants to kill King David. And he actually sends this group over to David's house. And that's when Saul's daughter says, look, you need to escape right now or you're going to be dead. And so she puts the idol in the bed, and they come and try to kill the idol, and thinking it was David, but he is long gone. And then Saul once again tries to attack David with a spear in his house, actually apparently repents and says, okay, I need you back to help me calm my spirit with your music. And then while he was playing his music, he tried to kill him again. And Saul once again sends men to David's house, and trying to kill him, and David is able to elude that attack. And then David escapes and gets in at Naoth with the priest there, and Saul sends soldiers three times to capture King David. And you all know the story in 1 Samuel. Every time this cohort of soldiers comes to capture and kill David in Naoth, they all start prophesying. The Spirit comes upon them, and they start prophesying in the name of the Lord. And then they come back and tell Saul, look, the Spirit of the Lord came upon us, and so he kept sending out more and more bands. After three times, he himself goes to capture and kill King David. He says, my soldiers can't pull us off, I'm going to go. Well, the same thing happens to him. The Spirit of God comes upon him, and he starts prophesying, and he's not quite able to pull it off. I think you get the point here. God is miraculously intervening every single time to keep David alive. He'd been anointed the future king, and so God steps in. This is not where it ends. Saul actually tries to kill his own son. Now, Jonathan is the heir apparent to the throne. This shows you the insanity of King Saul, that he actually tried to kill his own son, the one he was trying to protect. Because his goal in killing David was to ensure that the throne would go to his son. That was his whole purpose. And so the fact that he even tried to kill his son, why did he try to kill his son? Because his son was a friend of David. And he said, anybody who's a friend of David is an enemy of mine, even if it's my own son, even if it's the one that I'm grooming to take over the throne. And so David realizes the situation is getting pretty bad here. And he actually runs over to the king of the Philistines, the king of Gath in the Philistine, hoping to get protection from Saul by siding with the enemies of Achish. And you know the story there is they realize, hey, isn't this the one that they sing songs about, how he kills tens of thousands of Philistines? And here he is right with us. And then David realizes, they're not too happy with me being here. They're probably going to kill me. And so he feigns insanity and starts drooling in front of the king, and the king basically throws him out and doesn't kill him. And then Saul comes in and kills the priests of Nod and all the people of Nod. Why? Because the priests gave bread to David and his men. And so again, it shows you the insanity of Saul. He would even kill the priests just because they had provided provisions for David. And of course, David kept his loyalty to the those who did survive the attack throughout his kingship. And then David escapes to the town of Keilah. And this is, by the way, the town he rescued from the Philistines. So he saved the lives of all the citizens of Keilah from the Philistines who were going to wipe them all out. And then he decides to take refuge there. And then he prays to the Lord and say, well, Saul's coming with his army. Will the people of Keilah protect me? And he says, no, they won't. Even though you rescued them, they're going to turn you over to King Saul. And so Saul says, well, I better beat it, and I better forget about trying to stay in any towns. And he goes out into the wilderness, and Saul pursues David with an army of 3,000 troops in Horesh in the desert of Ziph. And it says day after day. And you can read the 23rd chapter. I mean, it talks about King David being on one side of the hill and this army of Saul on the other side of the hill. And he's literally only yards away from being captured and killed by Saul's army day after day. And then finally, King David decides to hole up in En Gedi. Now, this doesn't come across in the translations, but I've been to En Gedi. It's a box canyon like no other box canyon I've seen. It's a canyon, maybe about 150 yards wide, and it goes up to a steep block. If you're in there with a band of soldiers in front of you, there's no escaping. And so here's 3,000 soldiers of Saul, and they got David trapped in the box canyon of En Gedi, and yet the Lord delivers them. They basically crawl back into a cave. The soldiers are in the front, and David is able to escape, and even Saul himself goes in there. So what does David do? He crawls forward and cuts off a little piece of King Saul's robe while he's relieving himself. How he pulled that off, I don't know. So that's not an easy thing to do. But then after Saul was done, King David comes out of the cave and waves the piece of the robe that he'd cut off and said, look, you're in my hand. My friends with me were encouraging me to kill you. I didn't do it. And why are you pursuing me when I've got no ill will against you? And Saul repents, but only for a time. And he continues the pursuit. So Saul pursues David with 3,000 men to the hill of Hakalah. David's on the other side, somehow gets away. And finally, David goes back to Achish, the king of Gath, and takes refuge. This time, the king treats him differently. He says he knows that Saul has been trying to kill him and pursue him. And he says, you know what? I think I can trust this man. First time he came, he had no trust in him at all. But the second time, he actually says, okay, you can be part of my army, and you know, I will give you a refuge. And David actually marches out against the Israelites. Now, this would be bad news for the anointed future king of Israel to be marching out against them. But King David's kind of caught in that hard place. I mean, the king of Ashes has trusted him, and if he doesn't go out with them, then he's going to lose his life. And if he goes out with them, he could lose his life too, and he would lose the loyalty of all the Israelites. But God steps in and has some of the junior officers of the army of Ashes talk to him and says, look, this is the one they sing songs about. Don't let him join us in battle. And then King David, to make sure that he doesn't suddenly raise up some sufficient with Ashes, makes a strong plea, we want to fight with you. We want to be with you. We are loyal to you. But the king of Ashes implores David not to be part of the army. And so David is able to escape being part of the battle against the Israelites and King Saul. And then what happens? They retreat from the place, and they go back to the city of Ziklag. Now, Ziklag was a town where David's men had all their families. And when they get back there, they discover the town has been sacked and ransacked. David's men blame him for the fact that their town got wiped out, and all their women and wives and children were taken off captive. And so what did David's men threaten to do? They're going to stone him. So here's the men have been with him all these years while Saul is pursuing them. But now they blame David for the fact that their wives and sons and daughters have been taken off captive, and their town's been razed to the ground, and they're going to kill him. And God intervenes. Kind of reminds you what happened when David or Jesus was on the hill of Nazareth. Remember how they're going to push him over the hill and kill him? But it wasn't his time. And so Jesus is able just to kind of walk through the crowd and escape as if nothing happened. I mean, that's an outright miracle. They were there to kill Jesus, and yet Jesus kind of just walks through the midst of them, wanders away. As the text says, it was not his time. Well, likewise, we have 20 incidents this year where it's not David's time. Now, what I want to do next week when we get together is show that God actually does this in a different way, where instead of saving people's lives, he brings death. So it works both ways. He will intervene supernaturally to preserve your life. He'll also intervene supernaturally to bring death. But David saw many instances of God supernaturally intervening to save his life and the lives of his 30 mighty men. Now, I think one reason why God did this for David, so that when he became king, he would never forget that God is with him through thick and thin, and that he can't go against God's will, but if he's with God, God will see him through. Yes?
Christ came through the line of David, too, so
that's... Right. Right. Well, that's something actually taught on up at Reading, how Satan has always been after the Messiah all the way through the Old Testament. How, you know, the sons of God came down and had intercourse with the daughters of men. That was all designed to spoil the seed and to somehow spoil the image of God of humanity so that God could not fulfill his purpose through the seed of Adam and Eve.
Putting the wives in compromising situations like Abraham's wife or Esther.
Right, yeah. All through the Old Testament you see these incidences where I believe Satan is at work to try to spoil the image of God or to spoil the descent line that would lead to the Messiah. And I think that explains all the incidents we see in David's life. I mean, when you look at the behavior of Saul, none of it makes sense. I mean, he's even at one point trying to kill his own son. And he's angry at his men. So he's doing completely irrational things, killing the priests. I mean, how irrational can you be if you want to be the king over the Jews? I mean, the Jews aren't going to be very happy about a king killing the priests. But he goes ahead and does it anyway. We need to realize he's being supernaturally motivated by supernatural evil beings. Now, if you look at the politics that's going on today, does it really make logical, rational sense? Well, it's something that Daniel is told. Keep in mind, when you look at all the politics that's going on, all the wars and conflicts, it's not just flesh and blood. There are powers beyond that are worked behind the scenes. But King David was also told there are angels on our side that are also working with us. So don't be too concerned. Yeah, we're out of time. Okay. We're 5 minutes beyond. I'm sorry. We'll pick this up next week. Father in heaven, thank you for this time that we've had together here. Thank you, Lord, for all the evidence we have in King David's life and even our individual lives today, Lord, that you're at work. Lord, we thank you for how you intervened in miraculous ways in Mel's life to bring him to faith in Jesus Christ. And you did that with so many of us here in this class. Father, I pray as we study the life of David and look at Psalm 139 in more detail, that you, through your Holy Spirit, would remind us as individual human beings here in this class that you've done the same thing for us. And I pray, Father, we would encourage one another with our experiences of your miraculous interventions. In Jesus' name, amen.
That last slide that you had from the climate.